Another night of cosmology and astrophysics for the masses, or at least this one representative of the befuddled mass, namely myself, with three very sophisticated guests. They are Alan Hirschfeld, who is a director of the Observatory and Astronomy Program at the University of Massachusetts in Dartmouth, Massachusetts, and the author of the new book, Parallax, The Race to Measure the Cosmos. Evelyn Gates is with us again, as she has been once before, director of astronomy at the Adler Planetarium, and also a senior research associate at the University of Chicago. And Michael Turner, who is a distinguished professor and is these days the chairperson in the Department of Astronomy and Astrophysics at the University of Chicago. A good way to start is with the Book of Genesis, when you're talking about all that there is. And so I give you Genesis 1:16, and God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day, and the lesser light to rule the night. He made the stars also. That's added almost as an afterthought in that verse. He made the stars also. But it doesn't tell us how many stars he made and how he made them. Michael, can you fill us in on that?
Well, our conception of the universe has grown over the years. Right now, in the part of the universe that we can see, we believe there are 100 billion stars. 10 to the 22 stars in the part of the universe that we can see.
Or another way of putting that is there are 100 billion galaxies. On average, they've got
100 billion stars each. Yeah, that's just within the part of the universe that we can see. And we believe that we only see a tiny bit of the universe. And in fact, some people would say that we see an infinitesimal bit of the universe.
Why don't we see all of the universe?
The simple fact is that the speed of light is a speed limit, and so we can only see as much of the universe as light has had time to travel. And so our part of the universe is 14 billion years old, and so roughly speaking, we can only see out 14 billion light years.
Now, when you say our part of the universe is only 14 billion years old, that's a little different from what you would have said on this program, as you probably did say it 10 years ago, when you would have said the universe is 14 billion years old. Now our notion of what the universe is has in itself altered considerably, I gather. Is that the case?
There are quite a few new ideas about the universe and what it means on a much larger scale than we can even think about trying to observe at this point in time. So when we talk about our universe as cosmologists, we're talking about the part that we can observe, we can think about this 14 billion year old part of the universe that we can see. But we don't have any indication that the universe is finite, so it could, and in fact there are some theories that would say it's an infinite universe and we live in one very tiny part of a much larger.
Or another way of putting it, I gather, is, and isn't this what Alan Guth, somebody who lives up the road from Alan Hirschfeld, that is in Cambridge, Massachusetts, Guth is at MIT, doesn't he say there are multiple universes, the bubble model by which universes are being born all the time, though we are not in contact with them?
That's right. There's a possibility that our universe has many, many different connections to other universes, that our universe is very multifaceted, you might say. Guth's tremendous contribution was to point out mathematically that very, very early in the history of our universe, there was an event unlike anything that has followed since, a tremendously fast expansion of the universe, which he named the inflationary universe. Mm-hmm. So our universe is not only possibly multiple, but far, far vaster than we ever had imagined before that time.
And that inflationary event happened in something like 1/1,000,000,000 of a second, is that right?
Correct. Very, very brief amount of time.
What happened during that moment, that infinitely small moment of time?
It was the giant growth spurt. Mm-hmm. So in this, let's just call it a jiffy, instead of trying to put, you know, billionth of a billionth.
It's 1^-35, I believe.
Something like that, although that's a number we would like to know better. In that very brief amount of time, the universe grew in size by a greater factor than it has since. So, you know, this makes the growth spurt of young aspiring basketball players look tiny in comparison. And, you know, you were talking about the multiverse, and that has us all very conflicted right now. On the one hand, this idea of inflation, if it's correct, then we've discovered the dynamite of the Big Bang. This growth spurt is what we call our Big Bang. And And that's an idea that we're going to test in the next 10 to 20 years. But everybody always wants to go to the next level, because a logical consequence of inflation is that these little bubbles or growth spurts are happening all the time, creating other disconnected bits of the universe, mm-hmm. making our universe a multiverse.
Making it possibly an infinitely multi.
Exactly. And that's an idea that we don't know how to test. And so right now it's not science.
Well, doesn't Guth propound, or doesn't he, as he formulates it, the notion that all of these universes, these separate universes, are out of contact with one another?
Exactly.
You can't get here, you can't get there from here. Therefore, how can you ever determine anything about the other universes?
What he says is right now our equations tell us they're disconnected. And so talking about it makes us a little queasy, because it's not really science. The hallmark of science is falsifiability. But then if we step out 500 years from now and ask, what will they remember around, you know, the beginning of the 21st century? And they'll say, well, you know, this is when they discovered the multiverse structure of the universe, possibly. I doubt they will say this is when they wrote down these equations for inflation, because they'll probably think our equations for inflation mm-hmm. are as misguided and primitive as Copernicus's model of planets on circular orbits around the sun. So he got the big idea right, that the Earth is not at the center, and maybe we got the big idea right, the multiverse structure, but we can't test that idea right now. But we can test inflation, whether or not our universe evolved
We can't test that?
Yeah.
How?
That's what we're testing. Well, the big tests over the past year have come from the cosmic microwave background.
Mm-hmm.
So that's these microwaves that bathe us, that provide literally a picture of the universe as it was only 400,000 years after the beginning. And by analyzing the small variations in the intensity, which is in effect the map, we can trace back and test this idea of inflation. And a year ago, the first prediction of inflation, which looked like it was never going to come true, that we live in an uncurved universe, studying the microwave background allowed us to measure the shape of our universe and showed that it was uncurved. So that was the first big test of inflation. That was a year ago. And the second big test of inflation was about a month ago. Experiments done by a faculty member in our department, John Carlstrom, showed that the variations in the temperature from point to point on the sky, very tiny variations, 10 millionths of a degree Kelvin, fit the inflationary prediction. And so over the next 10 years, we're really going to test this. Another member of our department, Steve Meyer, is involved in a NASA satellite that will be launched in June called MAP, which will test inflation even more accurately. And so we are going to test the idea of inflation, whether or not there was this tremendous burst of expansion, and that was, in essence, the Big Bang.
Hmm. Fascinating.
But you want to talk about the multiverse, because...
No, well, I want to talk about all of this. That's why we've just made a decision to cancel the rest of the programming for this evening, and we're going to be here until about 5 o'clock tomorrow morning, if that's agreeable to everyone around this table.
Can't we stay longer than that?
Would you like to?
A lot of ground to cover.
But one thing we cannot change is the commercial schedule, so we're pausing for that. When we return from a quick batch of commercials now coming, I want to talk about not the absolute beginning of astronomy, but one of the great leaps forward, which is, in fact, documented in a story very well told by Alan Hirschfeld in his new book, Parallax, The Race to Measure the Cosmos. We looked up into the skies and we saw other bodies, and lots of people realized that this was not the light of heaven shining through little imperfections, but realized rather these were other places. But how far away were they? To begin with, how far away was the moon, which seemed very much in our face, so to speak? But how do you determine what the real distance is? That was a question that was raised for some time, and an answer was found. And the way in which the answer was developed is in turn developed in a fascinating account given by Alan Hirschfeld, and we'll borrow some of that right after we pause for these words. And we return in our quick cruise around the universe to Michael Turner of the University of Chicago, Evelyn Gates, associated with the University of Chicago and director of astronomy at the Adler Planetarium, and Alan Hirschfeld, astronomer and director of the observatory and astronomy program at the University of Massachusetts in Dartmouth, Massachusetts. That is not Dartmouth College. It is rather UMass Dartmouth, who is the author of Parallax, The Race to Measure the Cosmos. What were the first estimates we had of some of the familiar stellar objects or cosmic objects. The moon, of course, is the one that's been omnipresent throughout human history.
That's right. The moon, being the closest celestial body to the Earth, was the first to have a distance measured. And that was accomplished around 150 or so B.C. by the Greek astronomer Hipparchus. He noticed that in observing a solar eclipse where the the moon passes in front of the sun, where he was in Alexandria, Egypt, he saw a certain fraction of the sun covered by the moon's disk, whereas a few hundred miles away in Greece, they observed a different fraction of the sun's disk covered by the moon.
And he had friends in Athens who were corresponding with him on the
That's correct, yes. Yeah, they couldn't do it, of course, in real time. They had to wait for the ships to traverse the Mediterranean to find out. But from this, he realized that given the different vantage points between Egypt and Greece, you would get a slightly different take, a different vantage point on the sun and on the moon.
That is the parallax phenomenon.
That is the parallax phenomenon.
It's a phenomenon which can be easily duplicated instantly by any listener who's got two eyes.
That's right. You can just take your finger and hold it upright in front of your face, maybe about a foot away, and look at that finger with, say, just your right eye. So you close your left eye and just stare at it for a while, and then quickly open your left eye and close your right. And if you blink back and forth a few times, your finger will appear to be shifting left and right because you're looking at your finger.
But if you now look at an object across the room, perhaps 10 feet away from you,
the parallax will still be there, but it'll look smaller. The little shift that you see will
be
smaller.
A narrower shift.
That's
or
right.
A lesser shift.
So the parallax is intimately linked to the distance.
And to binocular vision, so to speak.
That's right, yeah. Right. We have two eyes separated by a couple of inches, and that allows us to triangulate on objects, that is to sense.
So they were doing that already
is.
in 150 B.C.
And before that, too. They were certainly aware of it beforehand.
When does it all become more precise? And how?
Well, that had to wait for a long, long time. Probably into the, I'd say, 1500s, maybe the late 1500s. This was still before the era of the telescope, which telescope did not appear until early in the 1600s. But in the late 1500s, there were astronomers such as the Danish astronomer Tycho Brahe, who built equipment to help assist the eye in terms of measuring.
Also built his own nose.
That's true. He was a rather argumentative fellow, and when he was young, he got into a duel, purportedly over mathematics, although that might be mythical, and he was at the wrong end of a sword. That sword lopped his nose off, but being a rather handy fellow, he constructed his own prosthetic nose out of copper, and he would rub it with certain kinds of makeup to make it blend in, at least to his thinking. But from what I have found in the record, it didn't blend in all that well.
But what did he do by way of scientific observation there?
Well, he developed a lot of measuring equipment. Maybe developed isn't the correct word, because even the Greeks had some measuring equipment. But he really refined this measuring equipment so that it would assist the eye in making very, very precise recordings of where, say, the stars or the planets were at a given time. And by doing that, he thought perhaps he might be able to measure the parallaxes of planets and the parallaxes of distant stars.
Now, how far out can you go using simply the method of parallax with proper available modern instrumentation and still get a proper calculation of the distance between Earth and whatever distant body you're looking at?
Oh, I would say now you can go out to a few thousand light years. By using satellites that can make even more precise measurements. And parallax is still the most reliable way of getting a distance because it's purely geometrical. It's using the theorems of geometry.
But it is by no means now the only way we have of estimating distance. We use spectrometry, don't we, as well?
Yes, so what astronomers try to do now in going even further out than these few thousand light years is to use what they know about the object that's emitting the light itself, so what they know about stars, what they know about supernovae, in terms of trying to find something called standard candles. So if you want to find the distance to something and you know how bright it is, you can take a look and see if you've got a 60-watt light bulb and you put it, you know, a few hundred yards away. You can measure how bright it looks to you when it's that distance versus how bright it is when it's much closer. And using that, you can estimate how far away the light bulb actually is. And it's doing exactly that sort of thing that astronomers try to do in getting further out with these distances. The trouble is that most stars and other objects don't come stamped with this is a 60-watt bulb made by General Electric, so that we have to find other ways to estimate how bright this object actually is, and it will appear much dimmer to us depending on how far away it is. But so what astronomers do is try to study different characteristics of stars, certain kinds of stars that vary in brightness, and you can relate the time change of that brightness to exactly how intrinsically bright they are. Or some of the most exciting things that have happened recently in looking at the most distant objects that we're getting supernovae, it's understanding these stellar explosions, so very massive stars, many more times massive than our own sun, when they run out of fuel, go through this incredibly violent explosion and get brighter than an entire galaxy of stars for a period of a month or so. And astronomers have been doing something very exciting in studying nearby supernovae, from whose distance we get first by parallax and then by leaping out using these variable star methods, and looking at exactly how the light changes when these things explode, looking at the details of the explosion from the light that you get, and looking at supernovae nearby, and then looking at supernovae that are now, you know, billions of light years away, and finding a lot of similarities in exactly what these explosions look like, and using them then as standard candles to estimate distances much, much further than we could get with parallax.
Something that is truly tantalizing is the news that has reached common folk rather than astrophysicists and cosmologists, that a large part of the matter in the universe can't be looked at because it's dark matter, so-called. And now, apparently, we conceptualize that not only is there dark matter, but also dark energy, so that the larger portion of the stuff that makes up the universe is not directly available to observation.
That's right. As we've kind of put together the recipe for our universe, we find out that 95% of the stuff out there gives off no light and is made of something more exotic than we are. So the recipe for our universe is, so people should get a pencil and paper for this, two-thirds something that about all we've been able to do is name it. We call it dark energy. Its gravity is repulsive and it's causing the universe to speed up. So that's two-thirds dark energy. About 30% dark matter. And dark matter, although it sounds mysterious, is a lot less mysterious than the dark energy. It's just particles that don't give off light. Particles that right now out at Fermilab, they're trying to create in the laboratory. So it's a new form of stable matter.
But why don't they give off light? What's wrong with them?
Well, they...
Self-respecting particle would
No, that's not true. Neutrinos don't give off light. To give off light, you have to be charged. So the self-respecting particles that you're talking about are things like electrons and protons. And so these poor fellows, well, actually, we don't know their sex, but they're not. We do know they're not charged. And so now we've worked our way up to about 95%. And then the last 5% is the stuff that we're made out of, the stuff of the periodic table. And even that last 5% that we can claim as our own and say at least some of the universe is made of is what we're made out of. Of that last 5%, only a half a percent of that is in stars. So most of the ordinary matter in the universe is not lit up because it's too diffusely spread out. So when you look at this cosmic accounting, only 5% of the total is the stuff you and I are made out of. Only a half a percent of the total is actually in stars giving off light.
The table of elements, what is it called? Mendeleev's table?
Periodic table.
The periodic table. How many elements have we now specified?
Oh, a little over 100.
Including some of the ones that have been sort of
man-made
in the laboratory. But this suggests there are many, many more elements of which we know nothing.
Well, not really. So the elements are made of neutrons, protons, and electrons. And so, you know, there's a pattern. There's still elements to be discovered. There may be some super heavy ones that are even stable.
Mm-hmm.
But this dark matter is an entirely new form of matter, not made of neutrons, protons, or electrons.
Uh-huh.
In fact, it's called supersymmetric matter. It was predicted to exist by the particle physicists who are trying to unify the forces of nature and the particles of nature.
We're now approaching the very exotic realm of string theory, I believe.
We're getting near string theory. That's one of the, plays a key role in string theory. So the particle theorists, particle people, really want to produce this supersymmetric matter to show that string theory is right. And a side benefit of this is that it's what holds structures together in the universe.
A free cup of coffee to anybody who could explain string theory in the next 2 or 3 minutes.
Well, I certainly don't consider myself an expert in string theory. I'm more of a historian. But
to begin with, it does assert that there are more than 3 or 4 dimensions, doesn't it?
That's the thinking. I think up to possibly 11. I think that these strings are supposed to be elongated. Can you call them folds in space, or elongated strands of energy somehow around which matter can collect, if I understand that correctly? And
yeah, sort of vibe, so that the string is the fundamental particle, and actually string theorists keep expanding this beyond strings, that there can be features in the universe that are membrane-like and going up to higher dimensions. But if we stick with strings, you think about particles, and different particles in the universe are just different oscillation modes of this fundamental string that is what makes up the stuff in the universe. So it's taking another step beyond sort of different individual particles and beginning to think mathematically, at least, about oscillations of these strings, which are so tiny that for all practical purposes, we can still think of them as particles when we're, you know, at current limits, smashing things together.
So it's not a string conceptualized as running across the universe like a line. Rather, strings are everywhere.
Yeah, string theory and particles are very, very tiny. There's also been talked about cosmic strings, which would be much, much larger sort of energy distributions in a string-like configuration. But that's a separate issue. So if we go back to sort of the particles and what the universe is made of, what physicists and astronomers and cosmologists like to do is break things down and find out what's the most basic thing. So when you're talking about the periodic table of the elements, that's all the different ways you can put certain basic building blocks together. But physicists want to just keep smashing things apart, in a sense, or, you know, finding out, well, what's this made out of? And that's the basic question that we're asking about the universe. And in order to ask what the whole universe is made out of, we also have to peer down into the very smallest realm that we can think of and find out what the most basic building blocks are in the universe. And what Michael's been explaining is that it's not the things that we're most familiar with. It's not the things that, you know, go into building up that periodic table of the elements. Most of the stuff out there is actually something even different.
Oi.
But what's interesting is that the cosmology, the study of, you might say, the largest object, the universe, and particle physics, which is the study of the smallest objects within the universe, they nurture one another. And there is this very satisfying interplay between the particle physicists and the cosmologists nowadays.
But how is the lay person to conceptualize other dimensions? I know height, width, depth, and time. I can understand those as four dimensions, the last of them being rather different from the other three, to be sure. But what is the sixth or the seventh dimension? Give me some sense of how I can conceptualize it.
Well, I was going to say that we would invite lay people to call in and tell us how to conceptualize these additional dimensions. We can't do it any better than anyone else. The one example that people often give is the following. Imagine some kind of hypothetical beast that live on a rolled up piece of paper, okay, or on a straw. And so you can clearly see that the surface of this straw is two dimensional. That you can move along the long dimension, and you can move
around. We're in flatland, are we?
Yeah. Now, if you keep tightening this straw, you know, roll it up tighter and tighter, all of a sudden it starts to just look like it's the long dimension, one dimension, because as you curl it up tighter and tighter, this other dimension, you can barely move along it.
Width disappears.
And so that's one of the ideas. That's the more conventional idea about the extra dimensions, is that the six additional or seven additional ones are curled up so small that we don't notice them. But the recent idea that is even more mind-boggling is that owing to the attributes of the quarks that we're made out of, we're confined to live upon a sheet or a membrane is what it's called. And so we're actually living in this higher dimensional space, which is very, very large. But because of the attributes of the quarks that we're made out of, we're stuck on a membrane. And taking it one step further, I see Melt's about to fall out of his chair, but I am going to risk going one step further here, is that one idea for how the universe began is that two of these sheets or membrane collided, and the heat from their collision is the heat of the Big Bang.
Of course.
And
I could have
but I would just say one of the remarkable things about where we stand right now is these are really scientific issues and questions, and they're quite remarkable. And I like to put myself, you know, reading a textbook 100 or 200 years from now, and it will have one of the following two paragraphs in it. Paragraph one, 100 years ago, scientists were so desperate to try to understand how all the forces and particles fit together that they invented completely fictitious extra dimensions. This illustrates their despair, and they were at their wit's end. Or it will say, 100 years ago, in spite of every evidence, every suggestion that there were extra dimensions, humans were so provincial, scientists were so provincial that they couldn't go beyond the four dimensions that we live in. And so it's very interesting. This idea is compelling mathematically. It seems to be some truth, but it's so outrageous and it's so radical that it might not be right. And so it will be, that's the only reason I would like to live for another 100 years, is to find out whether the idea of extra dimensions is right or wrong.
You guys, in a way, have an easy time of it as compared to certain other scientists. You can make theoretical predictions, and in almost all the other sciences, you can derive them from theoretical models, derive predictions, that is, and then they are, in fact, falsifiable. That is, they can be put to test. Now, many of your predictions can be put to test, but sometimes the time of testing may be deferred for 10 years, 20 years, or 100 years. So you can develop great models and never be held to account.
That's some of the fun of doing science. I think cosmology is also an excellent example. You know, 200 years ago, 100 years ago, there were a lot of ideas about cosmology and what our universe was and how big it was, and you know, even the most basic model. And there were a lot of different ideas. And one of the most exciting things about cosmology today is that a lot of this is testable. We have results coming in from these distant supernovae we talked about.
The conceptualization and proof is narrowing.
And it's very exciting. It's sort of this wonderful period to be working in cosmology when you do have data coming in that's in some cases, you know, throwing, you know, completely unexpected things.
Well, why
in.
Now? Why are the data more readily available than they used to be?
Well, I think it's a combination of three things. Element number one is having good, powerful ideas. When you have an interesting idea, somebody wants to go out and prove it wrong. That's the tension that really makes science work, is that people don't go out. We can never prove an idea right. We can prove it wrong.
That's the human base of science progress, as a matter of fact.
That's right.
If there's always somebody who wants to show
it. Well, exactly. And the second element that comes into play is technology. And so you name it, big telescopes, right? So we now have the Keck telescope 10 meters across. We have a telescope in space. The instruments on the telescope. So we used to use photographic plates, which collect less than 1% of the light. We now use these charge-coupled devices that everyone has at home in their camcorder or a little camera on their computer screen, that collect 100% of the light. So we've increased the light collecting efficiency by a factor of 100. We could not use the CCDs without high-speed computers with big storage devices. And then finally, in cosmology, we got to a level where we could actually sensibly speculate by having the Big Bang model. So we had a good, strong foundation to build upon. And so it probably seems a little bit brash, but I think most of us in cosmology now believe that we're living in a golden age. And I think maybe it's, you know, perhaps we should leave it to the future generations to say whether or not this is a golden age.
You left out one other factor. You've got more bodies. I don't mean stellar bodies. I mean human bodies. There are literally more cosmologists, more astrophysicists, more astronomers than there were 50 years ago.
Yeah, that certainly
helps.
I
don't know by what factor your profession has expanded, but it must be.
Well, we're recruiting a lot of physicists. A lot of physicists are moving because that's where the frontier is. That's where the excitement is. Mm-hmm. And
I was going to phrase it that we're just sort of expanding the definitions as opposed to raiding the troops.
I am late for some commercials. It was, I think, Heraclitus who said, "Bios dynamis macrocosmos." Life is the strength or the force of the universe. We've said yet nothing about life, that is about living organic beings. But as you know, of course, one of the great speculations that fascinates ordinary folk as they consider the broad extent of the heavens, of the universe, or of the multiple universes, is life elsewhere and the nature of that life. And we might chat a bit about the probabilities in that realm right after we return from these words. And we return to conversation with three people much involved with the universe. They are Alan Hirschfeld, who is an astronomer and really an historian of astronomy as well.
Yes.
And director of the observatory and this astronomy program at the University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth, Massachusetts. We've drawn a little bit from his excellent new book, fascinating science writing, available and intelligible to all who read seriously. That's titled Parallax, The Race to Measure the Cosmos, just recently published by Freeman. Our other two guests, Evelyn Gates, who is director of astronomy at the Adler Planetarium and Astronomy Museum, that's the full title now,
that's right,
of the institution, and is a senior research associate at the University of Chicago. And Michael Turner, who is the Bruce V. and Diana M. Rauner Distinguished Professor and Chair. I could never say chair. You're the chairman, and if that's not allowed, you're the chairperson in the Department of Astronomy and Astrophysics.
People treat me like I'm the chair.
They sit on you. They squash you. At the University of Chicago. What about life elsewhere? It's a simple, basic question, and it fascinates people. Years ago, when I was a college kid, Harlow Shapley came and gave a lecture, and it was one of the most exciting lectures I've ever heard, because he talked about the inevitability of life elsewhere. This was long before Carl Sagan was saying it, and long before I met Carl Sagan. I was an undergraduate at Brooklyn College when Harlow Shapley somehow magically appeared on the campus. He was already a man full of distinction and very senior in astronomy and astrophysics. And to many of us listening, it was an absolutely new and incredible idea. Other beings elsewhere. Possibly to our level or even higher, and possibly millions of such civilizations elsewhere in the universe. Does that still seem reasonable?
Yeah, I think we would only be more certain of that. And you know, the first number you asked for in the show was the number of stars.
Mm-hmm.
100 billion per galaxy, 100 billion galaxies in the observable universe. We now, one of the great achievements of the last decade, or of even the last 5 years, is that we've discovered 70 new planets, none of them moving around our sun. Mm-hmm. And so we can now say that a fair fraction of the stars out there, probably something like 10%, perhaps even greater, have planets orbiting them. And so that, of course, we believe is an ingredient. We don't know of any kind of life forms that can actually live in a star.
But of all the planets in our own solar system, it's only conceivable, though not by any means established, that there might have been some fairly low forms of life on Mars.
Well, right? Let's see, we have 100 billion shots in our own galaxy, and so we can afford, you know, a factor that says, yeah, you have to get them at the right spots.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, and of course, one of the great goals for astronomy, I mean, my great goal is to understand how the universe began, where it's going, and all of that, but other goals in astronomy for this next century, which I think have a good chance of being realized, is finding life somewhere else, or evidence of life somewhere else in the universe. And this is a very big goal of NASA's, to actually image an Earth-like planet, and to look for evidence of life through the chemistry in the atmosphere, look for signs of the chemistry in the atmosphere that are indicative of life occurring. And I think that we have a very good chance within this century of actually finding evidence. And of course, then there's the great optimists who believe in the SETI-like approach, where you send signals and listen for signals and mm-hmm. actually try to communicate.
SETI, for Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. That search has been going on for some time. It still hasn't turned anything up, has it?
No, no.
Where's the big array that they depend upon mostly now?
Radio astronomy installations. I think one of the primary SETI sites is actually in Massachusetts, in Harvard, Massachusetts, Paul Horowitz of the physics department has created a computer-controlled search facility for the kinds of radio waves that might indicate the presence of intelligent life out there. Of course, the assumption is that you have some intelligent creatures that have an interest in beaming out some radio signals, which we might be able to intercept. That has been going on now for probably well over a decade, I believe.
Have there been some false positives that excited people?
Well, there's an astronomical object called a pulsar that was discovered in 1967, which we now know today is actually a very, very compact, fast-spinning star called a neutron star. It's essentially a stellar corpse. It was left over of a star that exploded. But they were first detected by the peculiar radio waves that they give off into outer space, which are seen as basically blips of radio energy, very, very precisely timed. So when these were first detected, astronomers had no idea how nature could come up with such a precisely timed method of energy emission in any kind of star. And so there was some thought initially that maybe this was the discovery that would prove that life existed out there. But very quickly, and I should point out that although nowadays there might be a tendency for the discoverer to quickly rush out and have a news conference, at this time in 1967, the discoverer sat on the observation for several months to try and really tease out whether this was truly indications of life or not. And it turns out that it was not.
And that's the best false positive we've had so far.
Oh, I'm sure that in Horowitz's telescope array and in other places they have found certain kinds of regular or, for a time, unexplainable patterns
there
in the radio
energy.
There
were some things turned up at the Arecibo array, I think, some years ago, weren't they?
Yes, but
down in Puerto Rico.
Right. You're looking for some kind of radio signal that, is perhaps not quite as clearly cut as the radio signal that's beaming out from this radio station, but something that doesn't really resemble the kinds of radio static that most radio astronomers would recognize right away as just being natural radio wave emission from outer space.
But of course, actually, we know, don't we, Evelyn, that the evidence of life elsewhere is all of those secret spaceships, flying saucers or what have you, which have landed. And the government is hiding the corpses of these extraterrestrials from us in some big hangar. Where is it located? Down in New Mexico?
Area 51 in, I believe, New Mexico.
In New Mexico.
And it must be an extremely well-kept secret since
not very well. you could find thousands of sites that deal with it on the internet just by getting extraterrestrial life, I suppose.
You know, I think the best way to interpret that is the very strong interest that human beings have in trying to find out if there is life. Are
not
we
just
alone?
An interest in trying to find out, but rather a need to think that there is.
A need to think that there is and that it might be some kind of life form that we could communicate with that is in some way similar to us. I think it's understandable to search in this way, but I think what's even more exciting from my point of view is that there are ways to actually scientifically go out there and look for, Earth-like planets and even moons around other planets, the moons of Jupiter, one of them is.
But if you find Earth-like planets, I understand that we can, you were saying that the technology will enable us to really assess that fairly soon, even at great distances, but still within our galaxy, obviously. If you find Earth-like planets, that still doesn't tell you that life has developed on those planets, does it?
No, but as Michael was pointing out, you can look for signs in the atmosphere, different chemical signals that
of biological life,
as we understand it, that would indicate that some kind of life processes.
What sorts of signs would those be?
Ozone is a good one. So you're looking for non-equilibrium.
They're fooling with the environment.
Exactly. And it's interesting. You know, I think most astrophysicists would say that the evidence, still very indirect, for the existence of life elsewhere has gotten stronger because, for example, we now know that many stars have planets. Mm-hmm. There still is this famous equation written down 30 or 40 or 50 years ago by Drake, where you put together all of these probabilities. So it's, you know, what fraction of the stars have planets? What fraction of the stars with planets have them in the right places? There are astrophysicists, and I can't remember if Martin Rees has ever been on your show, the Astronomer Royale in...
I wish he had been.
In England. And he rather sheepishly suggests that perhaps within the observable universe, we are the only planet with life. It's certainly within the realm of possibility of the Drake equation.
That we're the great cosmic accident.
Within the part of the universe we can see is quite tiny. And it's interesting how different people approach this in different ways. So that would give us some special attribute. It would give us a special responsibility. I mean, if we knew that we were the only life form within, you know, the observable universe, 14 billion light years on a side, perhaps we would behave more rationally and try to preserve this precious gift that we have.
Gentlemen and madame, we come now to the moment when we pause briefly for an update on the evening's news from Andrea Darlis, and then we'll be directly back, though I might first say that we're opening the phone lines for questions that any in our audience might want to address to this distinguished panel. The number 591-7200, as ever, 591-7200. And if you're listening on in a neighboring galaxy and want to get to us, a phone call would be rather awkward. You can do it via email as well if you're hearing us on the internet. And the email address is extension720@tribune.com. extension720@tribune.com or 591-7200. Back to the action after the update on the news from Andrea Darlis. And we will be continuing in just a few moments with a few more questions on my mind, and then certainly with the questions that you want to put to our guests, to Alan Hirschfeld, Evelyn Gates, and Michael Turner. The phone number 591-7200, 591-7200. And as I said, if you want to get to us via email, wherever you are, you can do that by going to the address on email, extension 720, one word, @tribune.com. And directly back to the action as we continue to poke around the universe and explain it in ultimate and absolute clarity and full detail. But first, we pause for these words. And now we bring in another voice. We're talking about life elsewhere and the possibility of its being there. Years ago, only about a year after I started doing this program, a young fellow came on the program, and he and I discovered that we were from the same neighborhood back in Brooklyn, though we had not known each other there then. It was, of course, Carl Sagan. Here's a conversation concerning life elsewhere and the possibility of our ultimately contacting it. This conversation goes way back to December 4th, 1973.
As we will in just a few minutes, there's one question that's been on my mind through all this conversation. It's an indulgence of my own professional concerns and interests. There are social psychological implications, particularly in the question of what happens when we ultimately do make contact with some civilization at our own or at a higher level. We haven't done too well when bands of men, members of the same species, have suddenly come upon each other in a forest clearing. Indeed, bands of men called nations don't do too well these days in fully understanding each other and getting along in a cooperative, mutually satisfying way. What really might the consequences be when that contact is made, both in terms of how the contact will go, but also, of course, in terms of our own attitudes towards ourselves and the consequences for the further playing out of the drama of our own civilization?
It's a very deep question, and I can't pretend to have any definitive answers, but I'm glad to tell you what I think. Surely the history of our own species has been a very dismal one in this regard, and almost every time two societies meet and one is technologically just slightly more advanced than the other, the more advanced guys wipe out the less advanced guys, even though the less advanced guys may be better artistically or ethically or all sorts of other ways. And many people have a fear that that will happen when we make contact. I think that's unlikely for many reasons. One is that we cannot, at least in the next few centuries, pose a threat to anybody else, because the great distances between the stars provides a kind of natural quarantine. So I think it's certainly not an immediate problem.
They're safer on their side of the galaxy than we were in the old days on our side of the Atlantic.
Absolutely right. And another aspect of it is that I can, after all, the most likely contact mode is radio. So we have a big message, let's say. Let's say the Encyclopedia Galactica comes in. Well, we don't assimilate it right away. We have to understand it slowly. We have to test out each aspect of it to make sure we haven't misunderstood something. That's an enterprise of decades or centuries. That's not something that's going to happen right away. And it's kind of as if we just discovered, all of the literature of ancient Greece. We didn't know anything about them, and suddenly here was Aristotle and Plato and Archimedes and Euclid and Thucydides and Herodotus and those fellows. Well, we take a time for us to assimilate all that. It's one-way communication in time. We don't talk to Thucydides, but he talks to us. It would have a significant effect on our civilization, but slowly, at a rate that we could assimilate. And I think that's likely to be the case of successful interstellar contact. The final point I'd make is that once such contact were made, once it were clear that the alien civilization were very different from us, I think the differences among men would rapidly disappear, and the similarities between us, among us, would be entirely clear. I could see contact having a very unifying and positive consequence for men.
Well, I've got one.
He was a great speculator, wasn't he?
It was wonderful to hear his voice again.
Yeah, well, he became a pretty good friend of mine. Mm-hmm. It was very sad that he died as young as he did. Those are speculations that, my goodness, from 1973, more than 25 years ago. What do you think?
Well, I think very sensible, very logical. Mm-hmm. I mean, the calm, cool,
sure,
logic. Wasn't that his phrase?
Yeah.
We're marching along. I guess Carl didn't live long enough to see the plethora of planets discovered. You know, we've got 70-some planets around other stars.
He lived long enough to see the first one or two.
One or two.
And was very excited about them. Yeah.
And, you know, we're marching along. NASA has a program, very ambitious goals to image Earth-like planets and look for non-equilibrium mm-hmm. chemistry. And, of course, SETI is such a long shot, you know, because I think the point that he made that is so true is the distances.
Yeah,
is even our own galaxy could be teeming with life, but our inability to—I mean, we've gone to the moon.
Well, actually, that can be altered very quickly once we really apply ourselves to developing space warp.
Although I think again he got it right—is the first line of communication, the first line of exploration is light, because it does indeed mm-hmm. move at the speed of light, and it is very light in weight. You don't have to worry about propulsion, and
is that what space warp is? I mean, they do it on television. Why haven't your engineering friends got around to doing it in real technology?
If you remember, at our university, we do not have an engineering school.
No, I'm talking about it in general. Your science is linked to other sciences, and there are space scientists who do all sorts of wonderful technological things. Why haven't they developed space warp yet?
Well,
which gets you instantly from one galaxy to another, if necessary.
Well, Einstein, in his theories, imposed an ultimate speed limit on
mm-hmm.
material
speed
objects,
light.
The speed of light. And in all of these science fiction shows, Star Trek and Star Wars or whatever, they somehow get around that in ways that we don't know, some Hollywood magic.
Yep.
Maybe we need, you know, the Hollywood budgets.
Somebody once did a book titled The Physics of Star Trek, I believe.
Yes, Lawrence Krauss.
Yeah.
Yes.
Did he explain?
It was a very interesting book. What he did was go through, and he actually sat down and spent, I don't know, 48 hours nonstop watching every Star Trek image back to back as he was writing the book, but looked at some of the ideas that were portrayed on Star Trek and discussed some of them, which did have scientific validity, and some which did not. One of my favorites was something they had called the baryon sweep, where every now and then they would clean the ship out by doing a baryon sweep. Well, unfortunately, baryons is just, you know, more scientific name for the protons and protons and everything that the ship is made out of, that all the people on the ship were made out of. So baryon sweep would have wiped out everybody and everything, including the ship itself. So not the most practical cleaning tool.
Now, of course, warp speed was is necessary for Hollywood and for television, because unless you can travel many times the speed of light, you're not going to get any appreciable distance in the galaxy. You won't get anywhere during an hour show.
We're going to get somewhere. We're going to get onto the phones, in fact, right after another batch of commercials, which is waiting. So the number, 591-7200. Some lines are taken. Some are available. If you want to join us, now is the instant when you should be calling. 591-7200 for anything you ever wanted to know about the universe. For that matter, if you want to reach us via email, as I've said, the email is also open. The address, extension 720, as one word, extension 720, at Tribune, TRIBUNE.com. And on to your contributions right after these words. And we will go directly to the phones. Anything you ever wanted to know about the universe, here's the time to ask the question, and here are the people to answer it. Those people are Michael Turner, the chairman of the Department of Astronomy and Astrophysics at the University of Chicago, Evelyn Gates, the director of astronomy at the Adler Planetarium and Astronomy Museum, and Alan Hirschfeld, director of the observatory and the astronomy program at the University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth, Mass., author of the very valuable new book and wonderfully informative, Parallax, The Race to Measure the Cosmos, that's published by Freeman. 591-7200, and here is the first caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm calling in regards to your comment you made about the warp drive and its problems where you can't actually travel at the speed of light. It's the ultimate speed limit of the universe. But my impression of the warp drive is that the space in front of you is actually warped, so you are actually pulling that space closer to you while expanding the space behind you.
And oh, that's the way it's done, is it?
Yeah. Is that, am I correct in that, assuming that?
I heard that somewhere once. I think my son may have told me that, in fact. I don't know any details about the process.
And so actually, as you are traveling, you aren't exactly accelerating at all, except you're actually in a small, almost like a bubble, and you're just surfing through space while the space in front of you is actually being contracted and the space behind you is expanded. So you're pretty much surfing through space. You could actually achieve speeds greater than the speed of light, but not actually travel the speed of light.
Well, we should make clear that no one's ever built a warp drive, so we're not quite sure how it works. Now, the interesting thing is that within Einstein's theory, if you're moving very fast, then while you perceive that time is running at the normal rate relative to the rest of the universe, you're aging more slowly. And so, for example, if you go off and explore our galaxy and travel all the time near the speed of light and come back, not much time will have elapsed for you, and so you can live through it. But of course, the civilization you come back to, much time has elapsed for it. So that's...
Or in other science fiction versions of that story, you come back and your girlfriend is an ancient crone.
But I wouldn't call this science fiction. We, you know, with elementary particles all the time that travel very fast, they live much longer, as measured by our watches, than they do at rest. So that is actually a fact, but it doesn't quite work as well as warp drive. But at least it's a demonstrated fact.
Our thanks to the caller, and quickly to another. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, I had a question. Two questions, actually. One is whether a black hole can suck in matter at greater than the speed of light. And the second is, what is the highest practical speed a spacecraft could achieve with today's technology?
Well, hasn't he virtually given the simple definition of a black hole, that it does suck in matter?
Black holes...
At greater than the speed of light.
Not at greater than the speed of light.
There is nothing greater than the speed of light. Why don't we see the matter it sucks in? Why is it black?
Well, there's a point of no return on a black hole called the event horizon, where the gravity is so strong that even light cannot make its way out. And so that's the key aspect.
That's why it's black.
Yeah, that's why it's called a black hole.
It's worth noting that the man who I suppose has done did more than anyone else in the world on the physics of the black hole was Chandrasekhar at the University of Chicago.
It would be hard to say, you know, hard to judge who did the most, but certainly Chandra devoted, I think about 10 years of his life to the mathematical theory of black holes. And I think he felt that it was his finest contribution. And I think it was a very tremendous contribution to our understanding of black holes.
Yeah. What about the second question?
Let's see, I think current spacecraft orbit the Earth at around 18,000 miles an hour. I don't know how many times faster you can go than that, but that's probably around the neighborhood of what we would be able to achieve.
Our thanks to the caller. Let me read you one or two emails. Here's one which is very simple and yet I think well put. I've often heard that the expansion of our universe is due to, quote, space expanding. That would seem to mean that space is, quote, something. What is that something? Is space quantized like energy? Can it be measured in some way?
Well, I think that Einstein's contribution to our understanding of space and time is he said that space and time are dynamical. And so we're familiar with space around a black hole or any even just around our sun being curved. And another attribute of or another characteristic of the dynamical space is that it can get bigger. And so the expansion of the universe, when viewed, I think, in the most accurate way, is an expansion of space with the matter just being carried along. And then the emailer, I guess is what we should call this person, raises the number one question in theoretical physics, and that is, how do you marry Einstein's beautiful geometric theory of gravity, our most accurate description of gravity, with quantum mechanics? And that's one of the holy grails of theoretical physics, and we talked earlier a bit about string theory. And at the moment, string theory is the most promising way to try to marry quantum mechanics and gravity. And exactly what it means for the quantization of space-time is what the string theorists are still trying to figure out. Does this mean space-time is discrete? So normally you think of space and time as being continuous, but maybe it's foamy, and you can be here or here separated by some finite length. But that's one of the big questions.
Well, I guess we won't answer it tonight. Probably the next time.
Well, if we go till 5 in the morning, we might.
We might. 591-7200 is the number, and we go directly to another caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, I'm a first-time caller. I'm glad to be on the show. I have a question for the author. And, that would be as to the nature of Fermilab's trying to create dark matter. Apparently, they have some sort of idea as to the nature of it. You started to hit on it, but you really didn't get too far along that train of thought. And my question is, how are they planning to create dark matter exactly?
I don't know that your question is to the author. The author is Alan Hirschfeld, author of Parallax, The Race to Measure the Cosmos.
Oh, okay.
But we'll give him the first whack at it.
I think I'll defer to Michael on that.
All right.
I'll take the second whack at it.
Michael?
So we believe this hypothetical particle, which may provide part of the missing link between unifying gravity and quantum mechanics, we believe it weighs about 100 times the mass of a proton.
Wow.
And so what's routinely done at Fermilab is that particles and antiparticles come together, creating energy, and then from that energy, the rest mass of new particles is bought with that energy. And so if you have high enough energy collisions, you can create new particles. And at Fermilab, for example, they created the top quark, which weighs about 175 times the mass of a proton. And so this run at Fermilab, they've upgraded their detectors, they've upgraded the accelerator, and one of the big goals in this run that's happening right now is to create this new form of supersymmetric matter and get the primary stuff of the cosmos. And there's a race going on, just like the race talked about in Parallax. Astronomers have created specialized detectors to detect the dark matter particles, we call them neutralinos, that hold together our own galaxy. And I'm actually sitting on the fence rooting for both teams, because I think that no one is truly going to believe that the universe is made out of neutralinos until, first of all, we show that we detect the neutralinos holding together our galaxy and actually create them at Fermilab and put them in a bottle.
Okay, well, here, since you're answering my question, and no offense to the Alan Hirschfeld, your book sounds very interesting, and I'm going to run out and buy it. I have to know more about this dark matter. I'm wondering, where could I get the latest information on this?
Well, we talked earlier about, or maybe it wasn't on the air, Lawrence Krauss has a book called Quintessence.
Quintessence.
Which talks about the whole historical pursuit for dark matter. And that
and
should
if,
be available.
And I'm sure if the listener just goes to the internet and enters dark matter and then enters plus book or something, he'll be loaded with suggestions. Or go to Amazon.com and enter the same, or BarnesandNoble.com. 591-7200 is the number. You are next on the air. Good evening.
Good evening. I have a couple of real quick questions.
Everyone has a couple.
Could you comment on the kinds of mathematics that are being used in cosmology today? I know you've talked a little bit about this mathematical theory or these sets of equations, and if you could just comment on the kinds of mathematics that are used, and also in terms of the multiverse, is it countably many or more than that?
Or infinite.
One of the ideas behind these multiverses is looking at something called eternal inflation, which means that once you start a universe, meaning the larger entity, this multiverse, and inflation starts, it just keeps going forever and ever. So I have a picture in my mind of a balloon maybe with weak spots, and as the balloon is expanding, you pop up other little universes, and it's kind of an eternal process, and the idea behind that is it's likely to be an infinite number of other universes that may live for various periods of time. Some may be very short-lived, some expand much longer, like our own.
And that's sort of the consensual model these days, is it?
Too many to count.
Is it countably infinite or more than that?
I wouldn't try counting them.
Too many to count doesn't mean infinite, but maybe a finite but unknowable number.
I think I was being facetious. It's certainly infinite.
Yeah.
And again, I think we should emphasize that this is a very intriguing idea, but it gives those of us who are involved in the science of cosmology a bit of a queasy feeling, because it's not a testable idea right now. We can test whether or not our universe evolved from this inflationary mm-hmm. event, and I hope we do that. I believe we will do that in the next 20 years. The idea of the multiverse may take a little bit longer.
Yeah, I get the impression too that, and I'm sure this is wrong, but it's an impression. It sort of harkens back to the Ptolemaic conceptions where you have circles within circles within circles. And now I've got 11 dimensions and multiverses, and surely all the things that current theory suggests must in some way be simplifying the kinds of problems and questions that you've been struggling with. Yes. As opposed to, it just seems much more complex than it had been before, or at least that's the impression. But
well, it is interesting. Right now, when you describe, I described to Milt earlier what our universe is made out of, and you couldn't see his face on the radio, but I think some people are saying, you know, you guys are just making this up as fast as you can. And I think there
that's
is...
That's my permanent skeptical.
I think there is, right now... we're putting together this picture of the universe, a more precise picture than we've ever had before, and I think at the back of all of our minds is the lurking question, can we make sense of this? Why dark matter, dark energy, ordinary matter? I left out the neutrinos, which account for about as much matter in the universe as stars do. And so there are people who are very skeptical, more skeptical than Milt, who say, you know, this sounds a lot like epicycles. It sounds a lot like you are near a paradigm shift, and that could be.
I must add, I'm not skeptical at all. I'm somewhat dazzled or dazed, as I have been for many, many years in the conversations I've had with astrophysicists and cosmologists. And I read a fair amount popular material on this stuff. Yes, sir.
Can I have one other point or question? You had mentioned us, and I just forgotten the person's name in England who kind of speculates that, well, maybe we're it. I mean, maybe that's
the Astronomer Royal.
Right. Are you familiar at all with William Dembski and the inference design hypothesis, and I guess I'll throw the gasoline bomb in here and ask, you know, well, where is God in all this? And I'm sure that's, you know, not part of the scientific discussion, but, you know, if you're speculating and, you know,
no one here is familiar with the author you name, and as for God, anyone can say whatever they want. I just came from this afternoon from my seminar on the psychology of religion. So what do you have?
Well, it's a question that almost always comes up when I'm speaking to, especially like a group of high school students that is encountering cosmology for the first time and thinking about this and where does God and religion
sure.
fit into that. And it's, I think it's a very natural question to ask, and it's
and
a
the
very
standard
interesting.
Way you, the standard way you get there is, don't you have to posit a prime cause, and isn't that prime cause, quote, God?
That's not necessarily the standard way I would get there, but I would say that I think what you said earlier, maybe that these, you know, science is doing what it does best and trying to understand our universe and how it works and how it's evolved as far as we can take it with our science,
yeah.
and religion is a separate issue. And
now, I wasn't attributing that standard way of getting there to you, but I'm saying that the standard way that ordinary non-cosmologists and non-astronomers get there, when they hear this kind of stuff, is they then say, well, then don't you have to assume that God started the whole thing?
Well, it's a legitimate question. And, of course, in cosmology, we hope that our goal is to keep increasing the understanding. So the question that arises from the Big Bang theory is, so what caused the Big Bang? We now think the Big Bang, the dynamite behind it might be inflation.
Yeah.
And then the next question is, you know, who lit the match on the stick of dynamite?
Sure.
And maybe we'll find a physical cause. One physicist has speculated that nothing is unstable, that you can't have nothing because it's unstable and it will instantly spawn a universe.
The great question that leads you towards conceptualizations of God is Heidegger's question. He wasn't the first to ask it, but he asked it in this form. Why is there anything rather than nothing?
Because Valenkin would answer, because nothing is unstable.
There you are. One thing that is stable is the chronicity of commercials, and we're a little bit late for this batch, but here they are, and then directly back to the phones and to the email, 591-7200 or extension 720 at tribune.com. And we go directly back to the phones, the number 591-7200. You are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening. My question is, I've been rereading James Gleick's book on chaos, and as you folks know, it's being applied to everything from meteorology to ventricular fibrillation. Has it been applied to cosmology in particular? Irregularities in the Big Bang radiation is always considered to be stochastic, and formation of multiple universes is always considered to be stochastic, but could there be a nonlinear mathematical basis in which there's actually a pattern to this apparent stochastic variation? And then I also have a comment on the connection between religion and astronomy and the meaning of nothingness in a very functional mode. But first, I'm interested to see if anybody's working on applying chaos to cosmological problems.
So are you an academic?
Yes.
Where, would you say?
UIC. Hi, uh-huh. Michael.
Okay.
Well, I think chaos theory in cosmology hasn't really found a use yet, but certainly closer to home in the solar system. Our solar system is known to be chaotic. The orbits don't stay regular when you look at billions of years, and I think that plays a role in understanding comets shaking loose and the long-term stability of the solar system. But in cosmology, chaos just hasn't had an impact yet. Maybe it will.
Now, what were you about to explain to us?
Well, not to explain, but the way I describe the connection between religion and astronomy is, as you go reverse time back to t equals zero, you get more and more uniformity until at t equals zero, you have perfect uniformity.
Mm-hmm.
There's no distinguishing up from down, left from right, forward time, backward time. And so you can describe that state as a state of nothingness, because there's no way of distinguishing nothing from something. When the forces freeze out and when the particles freeze out, then all of a sudden you have something coming out of nothing, but whatever that something is, it all came from initial state that is common to everything that exists, from ants to trees to human beings. So this is a very functional way of dealing with religion, that we should have love for sort of an animist philosophy, a love for all matter, because we all came from the essential essence at the beginning, whatever you want to call it. You might call it God. So that's the functional way I deal with the question of connecting religion with astronomy.
And this puts in place the fact that my DNA is 98.3% shared with that of the chimpanzee.
More than that.
Yeah. All right.
Do you find that interesting, fellows, ladies?
Surely it's interesting.
Yeah, I also want to point out that in terms of the chemical elements that make up our bodies, you probably know this, but some of the other listeners might not. Shortly after our universe was created, the only elements that were formed, we believe today, are hydrogen and some helium. So that means that all of the other elements that make up our surroundings, make up our bodies, such as carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and so forth, had to be made someplace else afterward, and the place where we believe these elements were made were inside stars. These stars blew up one by one and seeded the interstellar medium with these new elements, and at some point this all collected together to form new stars, planets, and ourselves. So in some sense we are children of the stars in a way.
Sir, I thank you for your contribution.
Thank you. Most interesting indeed.
Let me read you another email. This listener says, I have a question about the membrane idea. If I understand the idea of strings correctly, would it make sense then to describe, quote, our membrane, comprising our time-space framework, as a sort of multidimensional interference front, a hologram, if you will? Does that speak to you?
I don't know about a hologram.
I've never understood what a hologram is, but I don't, I've seen
the idea of an interference pattern is an accurate description of
How so? What is an interference pattern?
When you're taking light, for example, and it's got not just an intensity, how bright it is, but it also has something called a phase to it. And if you think of wave crests in water or in any kind of medium, you can have sort of one that's up and one that's down, and when you have them meet one another, you can cancel out part of these waves. So you can play around with a water table and look at different interference patterns, and the same very similar things happen with light. And what a hologram is doing is basically giving you this three-dimensional picture to your eye, because it encodes not just the intensity of the light reflected by an object, but also these phases, which then allow your eye to interpret as a spatial distribution.
Mm-hmm.
But when I think about this membrane theory, you basically, I think the writer is right in thinking of our universe as one of these membranes, and we're just confined to live on that membrane, and all of the matter that we know of and most of the forces are also confined to move around on that, except for gravity. And gravity is the one thing that then can explore other dimensions in the universe beyond the ones that we know about. So they're sort of these intrepid explorers that go out and may encounter another membrane, which represents another universe that may have very different physics living on its surface.
Mm-hmm. Sounds reasonable. I'm ready for that voyage. 591-7200. At the moment, of course, all the lines are taken, but when we finish with the next upcoming caller, his line will be available for a millisecond. And here is the next. Hello, you're on the air.
Two quick questions.
Everyone is asking, putting them in two tonight. Can you level it down to one? We're short on time.
All right, one question. Is time travel possible?
Time travel possible?
Don't know.
You're not ruling it out?
Not ruling it out.
Where do we stand on that?
Don't know of any way to do it at this point in time. There have been different theories postulated to come up with some kind of ability to travel through time, if not people, then some kind of objects that you send through, and none of them have held up over the long term. The idea of things like wormholes as possible ways to travel through different parts of the universe, there are a lot of problems with the theory, such that even if there were a wormhole and you could create one, as soon as you put anything into it, it will close up again, preventing you from traveling through it.
Actually, though, Isaac Asimov, in his article, The Endochronic Properties of Resublimated Thiotimalin, report some findings which could be interpreted in a way as suggesting time travel is possible. You take the substance thiotimalin, it's a compound, and depending upon the degrees of the number of times it's gone through sublimation and resublimation, it will turn soluble a certain number of milliseconds before you add water. famous hoax article that he published in the in Astounding Science Fiction many years ago. And a number of people wrote in and said, we've done that in our lab too, but we get different values.
We did it first.
Yeah. We pause right now for a quick and last round of commercials. At the moment, there are two, count them, two lines available. 591-7200, if you've been trying to get through, now's your time to try again. And the email is available still, extension 720 at tribune.com. Friends, I have it right here. Email, being an avid Star Trek fan, I would like to offer the official Star Trek explanation for warp drive. A starship's warp nacelles distort the space-time continuum that push it into, quote, subspace. In subspace, a ship's apparent mass is reduced, thereby overcoming the restrictions of Einstein's general relativity theory. Did you know that?
No, I did not. And,
we should try it.
Let's build it.
Yeah.
You're right.
591-7200, as we go back to the phones, you are on the air. Good evening.
Professor Melton, panelists, this has been an incredible program. And I'd like to encourage Rick and Mike, your regular listeners, to also call in. My question relates to an answer that I got from an acquaintance I had on the train in the late 80s, who was a man who was a physicist. As I had heard, perhaps on one of your programs, Professor Milt, that the universe was formed within a millisecond or some extremely short period of time after the Big Bang. And my question to him was, well, given Einstein's theory that nothing moves faster than the speed of light, how could this happen? And his response was that it wasn't movement of matter, but rather the creation of space between matter or particles. Did I understand him correctly?
Absolutely.
Could you explain that, please?
Well, Einstein's theory sets no speed limit on how fast space can expand. And so the motion of galaxies away from each other has to do with the fact that the space in between them is getting larger. The speed limit applies to how fast you can move through space itself. And so one way to imagine this is to think of space being a rubber sheet that's being stretched. And there's no speed limit on how fast it can be stretched, but what there is a speed limit on is how fast you can move along that space. So the person who gave you this answer gave you precisely the right answer.
I thought he did. Is there any correlation between that and the possibility of a spaceship moving quickly? In other words, being able to create space, if I understand correctly.
Well, I guess you'd want to get rid of space to make the distance that you travel smaller.
Mm. Work on that one, sir. When you get it worked out, let us know how. I did want to ask before time expires, Evelyn, what's new, what's happening at the Adler? There are the two most exciting places to go in this town are the Ape House at the Lincoln Park Zoo and the Adler Planetarium. I've been to the one more recently than the other.
Absolutely, we have things, I think, that are even more interesting than watching the antics of those apes at times, including a cosmology exhibit, which if you've enjoyed this program and want to come down and learn a little bit more and actually see some of the instruments that scientists have used to study the cosmos and map out the galaxies. And one thing that we have that I know that no one else has in the universe is a notebook that from Alan Guth, who was the creator of the inflationary universe theory. And it's his notebook where he actually works out this theory for the first time. And being very modest, he has a box at the top of the page marked spectacular realization when he actually comes to the conclusion that he has an idea for this inflationary theory that solves many of the problems of the original Big Bang theory. So it's I would encourage people to come down.
Are you protecting it as you would a Gutenberg Bible if you had one?
Absolutely. It's a piece of history. Mm-hmm. That's just a lot more recent than a lot of our other historical artifacts that we have. So we have all of our conservators and the people that know how to handle, 300-year-old manuscripts mm-hmm. and artifacts that work preserving this piece of history that I think, 300 years from now when Michael is sitting and looking back and realizing that he was right after all and that we are in this multiverse, it will also be this wonderful piece of history that people can look at during this time period.
By the way, is it possible that Guth is wrong and that inflation theory is a mistake and will be somehow disconfirmed in time?
Absolutely. So far, so good. But as we've emphasized in this show, the suite of the plethora of observations that are going to be made over the next 10 years will really put the theory to the test. And the first two predictions have agreed with the observations.
Another quick email. What does the panel think about Julian Barber's The End of Time? That's a book I do not know. Do you? No one does? Then clearly he's not a well-established astrophysicist. We'll go back to the phones. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes. My question involves Fermi Lab and what they're working on at the moment. From what I've heard, they're planning on shooting some particles at a target that is several states away, and I believe they were neutrinos that I heard mentioned, but I'm not sure, and I just wonder what the geographic conditions are that make that area ideal for the target area. I believe it was up towards South Dakota, and it was something to do with the physical structure of the Earth, either the amount of iron or some physical property of the area.
Evelyn, you know about this?
Yes, actually the reason that you want to do this, and they're shooting a beam of neutrinos, the caller's absolutely right, towards a mine in Sudan. Sudan mine in Minnesota.
In Sudan, Minnesota,
yeah.
All right.
And the idea is that there are two important things. First of all, you want a long distance. You want to create these particles at Fermilab and watch what happens to them as they travel these many, many miles up to Minnesota. And you want to aim them in a target that's deep underground in the Earth in this mine.
Are they
mine.
Traveling through the Earth or
They're traveling the through the Earth, but neutrinos don't really care so much about the Earth. Neutrinos are particles that are basically don't interact with almost anything, and they're streaming through the Earth, through you, through everything right now without stopping. So the Earth they don't care about. But what we do care about the Earth and why you want to put the target underground is because you want to detect these neutrinos in the far detector, and you don't want to detect all of the other things that might also hit your detector and give you a false signal, things like cosmic ray particles, particles from the atmosphere that do interact with the Earth and therefore get shielding from this.
Are there natural neutrinos passing through the Earth?
Yes, there are a lot of there are a couple of major neutrino sources out there. One is the Big Bang itself. So you have about 100 neutrinos per cubic centimeter that are left over from the Big Bang, just as the microwave background is. And we know that those neutrinos are there. We also have neutrinos coming to us from the sun. So you make neutrinos in nuclear reactions, so you can find them around nuclear reactors. But the sun is a huge source of neutrinos, and I think it's 60 billion per square centimeter are passing through your body every second.
So it's the depth and the distance that that determine that for the location, and you can compare it to the natural background that you can differentiate it from the natural background easier with those conditions.
It's the background, and then also trying to find out something very exciting about these neutrinos themselves, to probe a little bit more about neutrinos and whether or not they have mass, as recent observations indicate.
Sir, we thank you for the very interesting question.
Thank you.
Time is virtually out. A last and quick question, if I may, to Alan. Can you imagine that measurement problems, that there are measurement opportunities with regard to those other universes in the multi-universe?
I don't think at this point there are.
But, I mean, if one thinks, projects into the far future, if we could ever get to them, we can then measure their extent and their bodies as well, can we?
I would imagine if you go far enough in the future. I mean, who knows what technology we'll be able to do for us then.
Can any or all of you imagine the state of astrophysical science and of cosmological models and our actual knowledge in those realms, say, 100 years from now?
I hope not. Simply because I think one of the exciting things right now is we're in this golden age of cosmology, and we're, you know, observation and theory are rushing together at great speeds, but we also have all these wonderful theories out there that are going beyond the things we've talked about with multiverses, and, you know, I'm kind of hoping that there are even more wonderful theories out there, new paradigms, new mathematics, new things we haven't even dreamt of yet.
Well, I don't think we have to wait for 100 years. I think the excitement over the next 10 to 20 years is going to be enough for me with the new observations coming in. There'll be plenty of surprises, and maybe some of the ideas that we have right now are even right.
You know, I can give you a little observation. It's kind of a parallax from different points in time. I've been doing programs on astrophysics and cosmology perhaps twice a year for quite a number of years. Every time we do one, there are exciting new developments.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I would say whether or not it's a golden age remains to be seen, but it is demonstrably the most exciting period in cosmology.
With that, my deep thanks to Alan Hirschfield, to Evelyn Gates, and to Michael Turner for an excellent discussion. And a few quick words about the next night or two. Tomorrow night, the State of American Foreign Policy with John Riley, the President of the Council on Foreign Relations, with Arthur Sear, Charles Lipson of the University of Chicago, and Dick Longworth of the Chicago Tribune. And Friday night, be sure to listen, because we're going to untangle the great Chicago airport controversy with a panel of experts representing all possible positions on the issue. And by the time we finish, we will have resolved the conflict and no one will have to worry about it any further. That's Friday. And tomorrow, our review of American foreign policy. And until tomorrow at 9, a cordial good night to all.